That was Pagode from Debussy's Estampe, performed by the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir Simon Rattle. And that ends today's In Tune mixtape, which was produced by Philip O'Meara. You can find details of all the pieces in the mixtape on the Radio 3 website, and you can download the In Tune mixtapes to listen to wherever you are on BBC iPlayer Radio.
What is it about this music that just makes me want to move? And this music... And what does that have in common with this? And this? This week on The Listening Service, I discover the magic of syncopation. And I try to learn from a pro.
Wait for it.
But suddenly it comes into focus and then you think, oh, I've got it, and then it's gone. Join me, Tom Service, for a syncopated edition of The Listening Service on Radio 3. Available now on BBC iPlayer Radio.
And good evening, I'm Chris Barrow. I hope you've enjoyed some sunshine today. Now, time for Radio 3 in concert. And Angels, Death and Purgatory await you in a concert recorded last Wednesday at the Barbican. Now there's a billing. Martin Handley was there.
This is the best of me. This I saw and knew. This, if anything of mine, is worth your memory. The words of John Ruskin that Elgar inscribed on the score of The Dream of Gerontius, which tonight forms the final concert of the BBC Symphony Orchestra's 1718 Barbican season. Hello and welcome to the City of London for this performance in which the BBC SO is joined by soloists Alice Coote, Stuart Skelton and Alan Ewing, together with the BBC Symphony Chorus and conductor Zachary Oromo. Edward Elgar was given a copy of Cardinal Newman's mystical poem, The Dream of Gerontius, by the priest who married him to Alice in 1889. The words simmered in Elgar's mind for almost a decade, until he was invited to compose a big choral piece for the 1900 Birmingham Music Festival. It wasn't immediately going to be Gerontius, but once he'd made the decision, Elgar devoted himself to writing it, with the exception of taking time out to learn how to ride a bicycle. He worked with great intensity, and in 7 months he'd finished the orchestral score. If that was an ecstatic time, then the agony was preparing the first performance. It was pretty much a disaster, with an underprepared chorus and poor soloists. Not even the conductor, Hans Richter, knew the score. Elgar wrote despairingly to his publisher, Jaeger, "As far as I'm concerned, English music is dead." And he added he was more interested in playing golf anyway. Richter, though, was still enthusiastic, and he told Elgar, "Let drop the chorus, let drop everybody, but let not drop the wings of your original genius." Well, Elgar may have been appalled by the premiere of Gerontius in Birmingham, but both audience and critics seemed to realise it was a special piece. Further performances, both in Germany and the UK, soon proved its worth. So why was Elgar so upset? It's been suggested writing The Dream was a wager by Elgar with himself against the insecurity of his Christian faith, which would then explain his bitterness about his perception of the failure of the work. It was the best of him, so if it were a success, that would be God's reward. Elgar never allowed Gerontius to be called an oratorio. Zachary Oromo suggested that was because it's closer to being an opera, a drama of the soul. I asked Zachary just how original he thinks the work is.
Given that it's quite an early piece by Elgar, and he had barely cut his teeth as a composer, I think it's the secured way in which he treats his material, the text being somewhat errant and kind of wandering in all different directions. And yeah. Somehow Elgar manages to bind it all together very convincingly with his music. And I think his treatment of the singing voices is remarkable in this piece. I guess the way in which he uses three voices that are closest to each other in the vocal spectrum, meaning an alto stroke mezzo-soprano, which is quite a low part, a tenor, which has a very wide range, and then a high-ish baritone or bass baritone part, is unusual. His treatment of the orchestra, as always, but very particularly here, is quite tremendous. The choral part, obviously, it does have its difficulties and strangenesses, but it is original.
Zachary Oromo. Part one opens with a brooding, mystical prelude before we hear Gerontius, the tenor Stuart Skelton, on his deathbed. He asks for courage to face the ordeal ahead. The chorus of his friends begs the Lord to be merciful and gracious, and Gerontius expresses his determined faith before exhaustion overwhelms him. As Gerontius drifts towards death, he sings, "Into thy hands, O Lord." The priest, bass Alan Ewing, intervenes and exhorts the Christian soul to go forth upon thy journey, with the chorus taking up the prayer. Stuart Skelton.
It's a very interesting thing to be able to imbue this role with enough physicality to sing the dying Gerontius in the first part, and in Act Two to be able to infuse it with this ethereal, disembodied quality, but with an Elgarian orchestra. There's something about being carried, particularly by the orchestral swell of this wonderful music. It's interesting. You don't have to necessarily be a religious person to get this piece, and I think you're never more religious than when you're singing it.
Applause for the guest leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Igor Yusufovich, joining orchestra and chorus on the Barbican stage. And he's followed by Stuart Skelton, Alan Ewing, and Zachary Oromo to perform part one of Elgar's The Dream of Gerontius.
by the token of this faltering breath, this cheered heart, this tenderness on my brow. To draw.
paths to be trod. Prepare me, thy God. And while the storm of that be
time. Omnipotent Father, move
That was part one of Elgar's The Dream of Gerontius. At the start of part two, the soul of Elgar's everyman, Gerontius, tenor Stuart Skelton, is ushered towards a new world beyond suffering. An angel appears, sung by mezzo-soprano Alice Coote, and Gerontius is full of questions for her. She tells him his new spiritual awareness is the first step on a journey to judgment. He's thrust suddenly into a diabolical world of chaos with a chorus of the demons who surround the judgment court. The angel tells Gerontius he's about to stand in the presence of God himself. As he crosses the threshold, the chorus sings praise to the holiest in the height. Gerontius is now faced by the angel of the agony, bass Alan Ewing, who must plead his case before God. The moment of judgment itself is marked by a mighty brass chorale. Gerontius cries out to be taken away, heading for purgatory, where the souls awaiting eternity sing quietly, Lord, thou hast been our refuge. Gerontius is folded softly and gently into the arms of his guardian angel. Alice Coote.
I say soul a lot. Soul is the most word I feel I often say. And it's especially a British tradition that mezzo-sopranos sing this piece. And there's something in it that you also hear it in the lower strings of the orchestra, that there's something deeply comes from your chest, comes from your heart, that you are holding this person, this whole soul, and doing your best for them to be eternal in some way. It is incredibly satisfying because when it comes down to it, it is some of the most iconic music that you could ever sing, some of the greatest melodies you could ever sing, and some of the most transcendent moments in all music, not just British music, in all music.
Part two of Elgar's The Dream of Gerontius.
For I feel in me. My task is o'er, It is a member of that family of wondrous beings who, ere the worlds were made millions of ages back, have stood around the throne of God. I will address him. Mighty one, my Lord, my guardian spirit. All
hail, my child and brother, hail. What wouldst thou?
I would have nothing but to speak with thee for speaking's sake. I wish to hold with thee conscious communion, though I fain would know a maze of things, were it but meet to ask, and not a curiousness.
You cannot now cherish a wit which ought not to be wit.
Then I will speak. I ever had believed that on the moment when the struggling soul quitted its mortal case, forthwith it fell under the
Thank you. my sense come the fierce hubbub, which would make me fear. Could I be frightened?
Judgment court. Have somehow disobeyed the courts everywhere. Every head dwells to claim their property and gather souls for hell. Is to the cross.
A sorrow unto the dissonance.
Thank you. Thank you. Until the long, long, long.
I think you will find Gerontius far beyond anything I've yet done. I like it. I'm not suggesting I've risen to the heights of the poem for one moment, but on our hillside, night after night, I've seen in thought the soul go up and have written my own heart's blood into the score. Elgar, as so often, linking the inspiration of his music to the Malvern Hills where he and his soul lived. The Dream of Gerontius has been performed here in the Barbican Concert Hall by mezzo-soprano Alice Coote, tenor Stuart Skelton and bass Alan Ewing, the BBC Symphony Chorus, Chorus Master Neil Ferris and the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Guest leader, Igor Yusefovich. The conductor was Zachary Olmo. Wonderful concentration from the audience here in the Barbican and equally from the performers on stage. Chorus and semi-chorus may not have the ideal amount of space in which to sing, but my goodness, did they sing. Stuart Skelton bounding up the stairs onto the stage and getting a terrific ovation from chorus. He has a way of winding the chorus up in the most wonderful, positive way. He pushes the music stands down so that the audience get a better view of Alice Coote and himself, and indeed the bass, Alan Ewing. The three of them taking their applause, being roundly applauded by everyone on stage, as well as you can hear, everyone in the audience. Neil Ferris, chorus master of the BBC Symphony Chorus, comes onto the stage, and he's trying to get his semi-chorus to their feet. And the rest of the BBC Symphony Chorus. Well, of course, they'll be performing at the proms, but they start their new season with Ethel Smythe's Mass in D, which Zachary Oramo, who's just come onto the platform, will also be conducting. And Neil Ferris said to me, if you fancy being up there on the stage with them, then they're after new choristers. Head for the website if you'd like to join the BBC Symphony Chorus. BBC Symphony Orchestra, recording next week. Sibelius, Lemminkainen Legends with Zachary Oramo, and then on Friday, May the Veil, 7 o'clock for Finnish orchestral music chosen by Zachary Oramo, including Madetoja's Third Symphony. Fascinating programme, May the Veil, 7 o'clock on Friday. Well, what's the transcendental ending to the BBC Symphony Orchestra's Barbican season with Elgar's masterpiece? After that, and the audience relaxing gradually, time for me to hand you on from the Barbican Concert Hall to Broadcasting House for the rest of your Radio 3 evening, which won't have it easy to follow that.
Thank you, Martin Handley there. Welcome to Broadcasting House here at BBC Radio 3. I'm Chris Barrow, and yes, we'll try our best to follow that excellent concert. Later at 10 o'clock, Kate Mollison is in Manchester to explore Lancashire's dialect in song with the performer and researcher Jennifer Reed. But before that, we have some time in hand, so let's stay with Elgar and his piano quintet in A minor. It's dedicated to Ernest Newman, the author of The Dream of Gerontius. John Ogden plays piano with the Allegri String Quartet.
Thank you. Thank you.
Elgar's Piano Quintet in A Minor, Opus 84, performed by the Allegri String Quartet with John Ogden playing piano as the fifth member. Elgar was reputed to be the English Brahms, so now we're going to hear something by the German Elgar, if you like. This is Brahms' Rhapsody No. 1 in B minor, the first of two that make up Opus 79. They were dedicated to his friend, the musician and composer Elisabeth von Herzogenberg. At her suggestion, Brahms reluctantly renamed the compositions from Klavierstück, piano pieces, to Rhapsodies. The first is performed by Radu Lupu. Radu Lupu with Brahms' Rhapsody No. 1 in B minor.
Nigel Kennedy. Danielle Denise. Evelyn Glennie. Some of the finest classical, jazz, folk, and world musicians.
No cares for me, I'm happy as I can be.
All from the Radio 3 stage at BBC Music's biggest weekend. Coverage starts on Friday afternoon at 5.
Good evening, this is After Dark on Radio 3, a late zone for stimulating conversation and adventurous music. I'm Chris Barrow. Later at 11 o'clock, we're heading to Cheltenham for jazz with the sound of trumpets and brand new guitar music. Before that, this week's series of The Essay looks at how shopping in the supermarket feeds into local identity. We'll be starting off with Rome. Now, it's 10 o'clock, so here's Music Matters with Kate Mollison.
Down in Shed on a summer's day, thawed sun shining through whitewashed top, Brids and Slater chirping away, and I whistle a tune to every cop, clattering loom and whirling wheel.
Well, if you didn't understand any of that, all will become clear. Today on Music Matters, we travel from the cotton mills of Ancoats to the leafy Surrey hills of Vaughan Williams' country. And an album in words, or is it a novel in sound, from the restless mind of Matthew Herbert? First, though, an unusual combination of music and movement. Composer Witold Lutosławski witnessed some of the most brutal and systematic atrocities dealt by the 20th century. He watched Warsaw being all but obliterated at the end of the Second World War, and then he was subjected to the creative blackout that was imposed on Polish musicians. After the war, he lived in a tiny apartment with a loudspeaker that was bolted just outside his bedroom window, broadcasting state propaganda around the clock. In the 1960s, he moved to the quieter suburbs of Warsaw, where I once visited his house, and I remember being struck by how he'd triple-glazed the windows, double-lined the doors. The point being that what Lutosławski came to value above all else was the silence and the space in which his own creative imagination could fly. Lutosławski never wrote for dance, but now the company Rombert has created Life is a Dream, which is the world's first full-length piece of choreography set to his music. It's based on a 400-year-old drama by the Spanish playwright Calderón about a prince imprisoned in a tower living out a life in dreams. Well, I went to the Rombert rehearsal studios to get a sense of the production coming together. The set is dark and austere, but also glimmering with elusive video projections by the Key Brothers. I spoke to the choreographer Kim Brandstrup, and first to the conductor, Paul Hoskins.